history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you with pretty incredible stories to tell. And we're never going to know unless we take the time to ask a few of the right questions and listen. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I was about to introduce you to a 99-year-old veteran in Las Vegas, but I'm going to save that until next week because this is Mother's Day weekend and the perfect opportunity to celebrate the women who have served in our armed forces. During World War II, more than 350,000 women were in uniform, and that doesn't even take into account the thousands more in defense-related jobs. All those Rosie the Riveter whose crucial contributions freed up men for positions closer to the front lines. Over the years on Hometown Heroes, I've had the privilege of meeting women all over this country who volunteered to serve at a time when the need was great. Nurses, pilots, air traffic controllers, Bond girls, and I don't mean James Bond. There were so many ways that women served in World War II, and I thought it would only be fitting on Mother's Day weekend to share a few highlights from some of those conversations with these lovely ladies who, before they became mothers, answered Uncle Sam's call. Before we're done today, we'll hear from nurses and WAVES and WASPs. If you were alive then, you remember those acronyms. But we're going to start with one of the very few, the very proud women Marines of World War II. June Moran was a senior in high school in San Diego when Imperial Japan attacked Pearl Harbor.
My dad let me take the car to church. My brother and I were, that's where we were. When we came home, here was the news on the radio. And my dad was glued to that radio like you can't believe, listening to everything. Just devastating, and it was unbelievable that this would happen to us, that someone would, you know, it was such a disaster, my goodness. And of course, no TV then. I mean, you didn't see any pictures until in the newspaper a couple of days later, but on the radio it was constant all day long.
And with your father having been a Navy veteran, and now most of our Navy has been destroyed, that must have been really hard for him.
Very hard. He kept saying something's going to happen. He would get news from the Naval News, you know, retired person. And, boy, as soon as that happened, he said, well, I'm going back in the service. And my mother says, you're too old. They won't take you. He says, oh, yes, they will. They want every man they can get. And he went. In 6 months from that, he was in, like, back in again.
Wow.
And so they gave him the rifle range at Camp Matthews there in San Diego, and that's what he had during the war.
Wow. I imagine that made an impression on you as a young lady, that this was important enough to your father that even at his age he would find something to do?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, he's military through and through, Navy for sure. And it's a Navy town. San Diego was just inundated with Army, Navy, Marines and so forth, so it was around you all the time. Plus the aircraft industry brought a lot of people from the Midwest out there to work, and that's when the women started working, Rosie the Riveter, etc. I worked down at Broadway Pier, and I saw so many troop ships being loaded with Army and Marines, and it was just a tremendous amount of men that they could get aboard one of these ships. And then they had a USO in downtown San Diego. You used to stop there and see the fellows and, you know, dance with them. And so you got to know them pretty, but they were pretty nice guys that were in the Marine Corps, and that kind of influenced me, I think. And I think my dad was a little disappointed that I didn't go in the Navy. And so he asked why, and I said, well, I didn't like the uniform. It was too sloppy. No, he couldn't argue with that. He said, okay, but I think he was a little crushed. But
so if I read between the lines, it sounds like the guys that came down from Camp Pendleton just looked really good, and you were hoping to meet one of them?
Oh, I met quite a few.
How did your mother feel about you joining the Marines?
Not happy, not happy. But she was very happy that her sons were not the same age as her daughter, so they would have been gone. And they all did serve later in the services, but they were too young to go to war. So she was very happy about that.
Well, I'm sure they had to sign up after their big sister was a Marine. They had to try to live up to that example. So what was it like getting welcomed to the Marine Corps? Was boot camp difficult?
Boot camp was something else. Yeah, it was very difficult. You didn't even know your own name the first week. Somebody's yelling at you all the time, you know, do this, do that, blah, 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 blah. And as long as you do what they say or jump as high as they want you to jump, you're okay.
And are these women who are training you or men?
We had men DIs, the drill instructors. But other than that, it was women. And we had one gal scared the heck out of us. I think she looked like she was 7 feet tall. She was from Texas, and she had, believe it or not, she had a swagger stick. I mean, she was in control, and you were just a lowlife down here. And she let you know it every day, tells you. And don't think the Marine Corps will do the thinking for you. Okay. So as long as you went along with it, didn't let it get to you, you're okay.
Did you have an idea of what kind of duties you were hoping to receive as a woman Marine?
Well, I knew I wasn't going to be going overseas, that's for sure. So what their motto for the women, WRs, were this, to free a man to fight. And so we replaced a lot of the fellows in different occupations. I ended up in the personnel office, which was in the general's building, which was quite a ways away. We hoofed it every day. There we had a motor pool. Some gals were really mechanics. Anything that they could release the man to go and do, well, they replaced them. And that was the idea. The fellow that I replaced was so happy to see me. He said, "Sweetheart, am I glad to see you?" And he grabs me and twirls me around in the office where I'm supposed to be and then plunks me down, grabs his hat. He was out the door. He was so happy to be relieved to get to go out and get killed. But they just could hardly stand not to be in the action, the fellas. They really, really wanted to do it. And we had a sergeant major, an old salt, that had at least probably 30 years in. But he was pretty nice about it. There were a lot that didn't feel the women should be in at all. I mean, what are you doing to my Marine Corps letting women in here? But he was pretty neat with it. And the guys were really happy to see us come in and take over their job so they could get the heck out of there. It was quite an experience, and I'm glad that I did it.
You know, the Marine Corps has a saying, and it's part of the recruitment strategy for the Marine Corps. They say, the few, the proud, the Marines. I guess it's the fewer, the prouder, the female Marines of World War II, because that's a much smaller number. What are you most proud of with your service in World War II?
I think that I made it, that I completed it.
Have you ever gotten any funny reactions when you tell people, yeah, I was a Marine in World War II?
They don't believe it, really. Huh? Well, they really weren't aware so much of women Marines as they were the WACs or the WAVES, because they had bigger numbers, and they also went overseas, and there were a lot of nurses in the WACs, of course, and I think they were more known than we were.
What do you think people today should remember about World War II and what millions and millions of Americans, not just men, did back then?
I don't know. You would think that would have been, as they say, the war to end all wars, but we know that it's not true. But it's astounding how many people were killed in that war. It's just unbelievable to me now that when you hear of the numbers, and I have been over to Normandy to see the beaches and the bunkers that are still there, and that beach over there is tremendous. I mean, it's huge. And to think of all those men on that beach and all that were slaughtered, you might say, because they were, especially if you saw the movie D-Day, That's the way it was, but it was just tremendous, and I hope never again.
In addition to Normandy, June has been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., with Central Valley Honor Flight out of California. The next voice we're going to hear from is that of Irma Justice Smith. I met her at the World War II Memorial in 2011 when she was visiting with Honor Flight South Carolina. Irma was a school teacher who had graduated from the University of South Carolina and eventually became one of the founders of Columbia Christian School there. You'll hear how she looked at her time as one of World War II's Navy waves, women accepted for volunteer emergency service, as a life-changing experience. But the first thing out of her mouth at that memorial was a reaction to this expansive monument itself.
Awesome. I cannot believe it. Most fantastic thing I've ever seen in my life.
When you heard that there was such a thing as an honor flight and you could come out here and not have to pay for it, how exciting was that?
Very exciting. I applied for it right away.
Now tell me how you got into the service. I understand you were in the waves during World War II.
Yes, I was. I grew up in a small town, Pahokee, Florida. I knew that I would never get out of Pahokee unless I joined the service, so that's why I joined the service.
And you saw one of those waves posters and said, I want to do that?
That's right. And I did. When I became 21.
What kinds of things did they have you do?
I worked in an office of Bureau of Naval Personnel, identification work, identifying all the Navy people with fingerprints. But I worked mostly in the office, so.
And I'm sure there were some guys in their bell-bottoms around, right?
In fact, I married one of them.
So Uncle Sam was good to you, gave you a husband.
He sure was. Well, my husband, he had gone to OCS and had gotten his commission. I came into the office and I saw him. He said to see the older people who had been in that department since World War I. But it wasn't really that. There were a lot of pretty ways there. And so his ship would come into New York. He would come down every weekend. And that's how we just fell in love.
You ever think about how your life would have been different if you hadn't decided to join the Navy?
Yes, I do. I would still be down in that little country town of Pahokee, Florida, picking beans.
What did it mean to you when you heard that the war was over?
Listen, I was in New York City in a taxi cab waiting to go to a train station to come back to Washington when we heard the war was over. Everything broke out in New York City. It was wonderful.
That's not you in that famous picture, is it?
No.
Kissing the Navy man?
No, no. No. But it was an exciting time, though, to see that the war was really over.
When you think about kids and grandkids and future generations of America, what do you think it's important for them to know and remember about World War II and what men and women did then?
I think that we should tell them about it, show them pictures, keep telling them about their grandparents and their loved ones who served in the service, and not to let them be forgotten, ever be forgotten.
Well, Irma Justice Smith will never be forgotten. She passed away last August at the age of 93. This will be her daughter Vivian's first Mother's Day without her. And I know we could all hear her smile through the radio, but you can find a World War II era photo of Irma's smile, along with all the other women you're going to hear from today, at hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our first break, but when this special Mother's Day weekend edition of Hometown Heroes continues, we'll meet more moms who found ways to support our country during World War II. From flying planes to taking care of wounded warriors, their contributions were a giant part of America's war effort. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Hometown Heroes. proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Mother's Day edition celebrating some of the 350,000 women in uniform during World War II. Most of the women we've heard from over the years on this show would become mothers only after meeting their future husbands in the course of their military service in World War II. We'll hear more of those match-made-in-uniform stories. But I also want you to hear from nurses, from Pearl Harbor to D-Day to the Bulge to those intense battles of the Pacific. The thousands wounded in all of those engagements received care and comfort from nurses. And we have heard some striking memories from those nurses here over the years, like a young lady from Oklahoma who found herself at Mare Island Naval Hospital in California.
Our quarters at Mare Island was beautiful. We had lovely quarters. And so they got the house mother and got me a bed, and I fell into bed. And the next day, I met the gal who was head of surgery. And she says, I said, yes, I'm just coming into the Navy. And I've had lots of experience. Lied like a dog in surgery. And immediately, I was sent to the operating rooms.
Right then. And how much experience did you have in surgery?
Other than what I'd had in nurse's training.
Not much.
No. But you see, the corpsman did the work, and we supervised. I had dirty surgery, and then I had 3 skin graft wounds. Now, Mare Island was filled with Pearl Harbor burns, and we did lots of skin grafting. But then they didn't have regular surgeons that were good. They would have doctors that were specialized in skin grafting from San Francisco come mm-hmm. out to Mare Island, do the skin grafting.
So I'm just imagining what it must have been like to be you. You're 21 years old. You're halfway across the country from everything you've ever known or been around. You're going to be involved in these kind of surgeries that you've never seen or witnessed or been involved with before. And then there's all these guys, and you know what's happened to them. They were at Pearl Harbor. They were not killed, but pretty close to it.
That's right. And these boys, when they'd come into dirty surgery, see, they opened up the Japanese camps. And they sent their boys, and oh, the Japanese mistreated our boys. Oh, that, it took me years to like the Japanese after I got out of the service.
And this is going to be later on in your time when you get these returning prisoners of war. But at this time, with those Pearl Harbor survivors that you guys are treating, can you give us an example of what kind of injuries,
There was all kinds. There was bones. Now, they did a lot. Do you know what a revision for a stump? They'd take and they'd cut back the shrub to here and put a flap over it so they could put the prosthesis. Well, they had big prosthesis, and they made the prosthesis right there at Mare Island.
So manufacturing prosthetics for sailors who had lost limbs, lost
yes,
legs,
yes.
had just one leg.
Or an arm or so forth. Mm-hmm. And they'd have to do a revision for the arm or the leg or so forth. So that was one surgery. But you see, these corpsmen did the work.
You're there watching, observing, making sure it all goes right.
Yes.
Grabbing something if they need it.
Yeah. We didn't have very many nurses in surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And the corpsmen were good. They were young men that didn't make it into medical school. They joined the Navy, and then they were going to go back to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
But they were smart young people.
Did you interact at all with the patients?
I met this wonderful husband of mine. Where's the picture? Okay. My dear, charming husband had 4 left feet. He wasn't a good dancer.
And I've heard of 2 left feet, but not 4 left
yeah.
feet.
And he wasn't good at dancing. And so I would go to the officers' club, and I would dance with everybody else. And he'd sit on the with his buddies from SOQ. And
tell everyone what SOQ means.
Sick officers' quarters.
Mm-hmm.
See, he had been on an LSD, and the crane broke and knocked him 20 feet down the hatch and broke every bone in his left foot. So he was at Mare Island getting his left foot
mm-hmm.
cleaned up.
And he wasn't, you're calling him your husband now, my dear husband, but he was a stranger At this point, you didn't know who he was.
Well, I met him, but he was at SOQ and with all the gang.
Uh-huh.
Anyone in the service you agreed with.
Mm-hmm.
By that, you accepted him. So then we started dating.
What stood out about him? What made you think, yeah, this guy, of all the guys around here, because there's plenty of wounded soldiers here you could deal with.
He was very brilliant.
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 Uh-huh.
And I was very intrigued with his knowledge.
Looks like a pretty good-looking sailor there, too.
He was very good-looking. Well, come on, so was I good-looking.
And if you want proof, we'll put these pictures up at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. So I'm sorry to interrupt there. So you meet this young man, but he would never dance with you because of
the foot injury? He didn't dance well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was too busy dancing with everybody else.
I guess so.
Then we had a Halloween costume, and I went as a Tahitian girl. And I was in a Tahitian sarong, and I won first prize. I won a case of champagne, but I didn't get one bottle of the champagne. Everybody else drank it.
Uh-huh.
So anyway.
So this is obviously an important job, and for these guys who are being treated there at the hospital at Mare Island, it's life and death, but it sounds like you're having yourself a lot of fun.
Well, the thing of it was, everybody knew me because I was in surgery. I was a nurse from, because see, all of them would come to surgery for some type or other and so forth, and then meet me, and my mother couldn't take this when she came to mine. They'd meet you, and they'd take their stump, and they'd shake it in your face and say, "Hi, Miss Garrett, how are you today?" And
you just got used to that.
Well, you just, yeah.
Was it ever hard to see that? To see that these are guys that
No, you just got used to it. Well, to a lay person, it would be hard.
Mm-hmm.
My mother just couldn't take it.
Did you ever think about the burden that these guys were going to carry? Or what it reflected?
How they were going to be accepted when they left the Navy. Mm-hmm. Because they were in their element. They were with other people with maybe both legs gone or an arm or both arms and so forth. I've often wondered how they made it. Because it was naturally hard on them.
Well, sure. And this, I mean, here's this war. I mean, 16 million Americans would end up serving. More than 400,000 died.
Yeah.
That's a heavy price. But the guys you worked with paid a really heavy price, too.
Oh, yes. And see, so many of mine were Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
They were the burns, and the burns were bad.
And one of the patients there at Mare Island whose burns were extremely bad was Donald Stratton. He had been engulfed in flames on the USS Arizona, but survived after being thrown a rope from the USS Vestal close by. Don's going to be headed to Washington, D.C. soon to try to secure the Medal of Honor for the sailor who saved his life on December 7, 1941. But the care from nurses like Peggy at Mare Island also helped preserve his life and his limbs.
Went through a lot of skin grafts and a lot of stuff, a lot of baths and a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm and kept the burns open to the healing air.
And not only would he heal up over the course of a year, but he would re-enlist in the Navy and serve the rest of the war on a destroyer, a testament to his patriotism and devotion to duty, but also to the devoted work of those nurses like Peggy at Mare Island Naval Hospital. The war in Europe overwhelmed medical personnel there, too. Filda Brodalski passed away last year at the age of 96, but when she appeared on this program with her husband and fellow veteran, Ted, she explained what it was like to arrive at Normandy's Utah Beach 10 days after D-Day in 1944.
There were only 5 hospitals on the beach at that time. And we only had a 5-mile region they had captured. And one was going towards France. The other was going up the peninsula to Cherbourg. And we set up our hospital in a field. And 3 hours after we opened up, we had to shut down because we had 300 patients. I had them. I was pre-op nurse. I had them all over the field. I had them in three Army tents, hospital tents, We were just overloaded.
Now, I'm sure when you went over on the ship, you had an idea of what it was going to be like, and you probably felt like you were somewhat prepared for this, right?
Well, not really. You think you are, but boy, it's a lot different from what you think.
What was the hardest thing, the thing that really struck you the most and maybe overwhelmed you the most? Was it just the sheer numbers of casualties? Was it what they looked like? Can you give us a sense of what that was experience was like emotionally for you?
It was hard. In pre-op, we had mostly the patients with the broken legs and the, you know, the minor surgery. Major Emory had the shock tent, which is the beginning of the special unit that you have today. And we had a few of his patients that we kept if we had time, but mostly it was the minor surgery, if you can call it minor. And we used to prepare them for the surgery and get them through as fast as we could.
You talked about thinking that you were prepared, but quickly realizing that you couldn't possibly be prepared for this.
In our day, nurses didn't give intravenouses. They didn't do a lot of the things that nurses do today, but I learned very quickly how to do it on the beach.
Exactly. And I'm sure you also learned very quickly that there were some soldiers that you just couldn't do much for. How hard was that for you to come to grips with that fact?
It was rough. I can remember in Aachen, Germany, where we were stationed in a barracks and had made a hospital out of it. And it was Christmas time when the Hertzkin Forest began to bulge. And I came on duty that night, and the fellas, the Red Cross people had decorated all the rooms, and the fellas were singing and feeling pretty good because it was Christmas. And right smack in the middle of the ward was this poor 18-year-old dead. No one around him realized it. So I got him out, had my corpsman take him out right away. But it just hit at Christmas time. That was pretty bad.
I can tell it still bothers you today, and I think everyone understands why. I've got to ask you, at this time, and women were a huge part of the American effort in World War II, not just in the service, but back at home as well. But when you are out there, vastly outnumbered by all these men, what was that like? Was it hard to be a woman around all these guys?
Not really. You were just what you were. You know, you were a nurse or you were a corpsman and stuff. And I had two wonderful corpsmen. One was a corporal, the other was a sergeant. And they looked out for me. They took care that I didn't get into trouble, you know. And no, we all just like family, really. That's what it was like.
Did you go into it thinking this was a dangerous job, or were you fooled into thinking that since you were wearing a Red Cross?
I just knew how I was going to go in. If Lena could do it, then I could do it.
When did you realize that it didn't matter if you had a Red Cross on, or you were wearing a nurse's uniform, or you were officially a non-combatant, that you could be in danger yourself?
Oh, yes. We were in a rest period in France, in between changes, and one morning about 6 o'clock, this airplane comes over and drops a bomb just over the hedgerow from where the nurses were. So we could have died if it hadn't been a dud. And then another time was when they were strafing the road, and they would come right up to the area where we had our Red Cross, and then they would stop on the other side. Fortunately, they did that. They lived by the Red Cross rules. But if they hadn't, you could have said goodbye.
We wouldn't be having this conversation right now, that's for sure. What would you say was the hardest thing for you to overcome in your whole experience as a nurse in World War II? The biggest challenge, or I'm sure you had some days where you thought, you know what? This is hard. I don't know if I want to wake up and do this tomorrow.
You got very tired. We didn't have days off. You worked 12 hours to 18 hours a day. And some days it was just packed with ambulances bringing in the wounded that you wondered what in the world you were ever going to do. Because you thought you'd never get through handling the injured, the thing that bothered me the most was the food. It was horrible.
You mean you didn't have homemade ravioli and spaghetti like growing up in an Italian family in Massachusetts?
K-rations were pretty good, but then we start getting the other kind of food. And I swear the stew was made out of horse meat. And I just couldn't eat it. That's why when we came to the end of the war, my heart had kicked up again. And I was down to 98 pounds.
Now, you mentioned your heart. And I don't think we touched on this earlier in the conversation. And I've met a lot of veterans over the years who maybe they lied about their age. And you had to tell a little white lie yourself to get a uniform on. Tell me about that.
I was doing private duty nursing, waiting to go in the service to take my exam, my health exam. And I happened to know this doctor on a maternity ward who was at Westover Field. He was a captain. And he did my physical, and he took 5 pounds off, and I mean, he added 5 pounds, and told him that it was a murmur that was generic. It wasn't anything else.
So you knew you had a heart condition that would disqualify you?
Yeah, Dr. Henderson had told me when I was in training, but I didn't tell them.
You must have been sweating it out a little bit to see if you would get found out.
I was worried that I wouldn't get through the physical, but with the help of my friend, I got into it.
So we took a little detour to fill in that story there. You were saying that after you'd been in for a while and been through some of these battles and treated so many soldiers, as you got tired, you were losing weight, your heart was bothering you again. How did you get through those situations? Was there something from your childhood, from your support system, from your beliefs that helped you overcome those challenging times?
I don't know. I just know that I was going to go in. I was determined I was going to go in.
What about enduring the rest of the war once you'd been over there and experienced so much of it? Do you remember a time where there was something that kind of lifted your spirits or helped you keep going?
Not really. You just enjoy doing your work, feeling that you were doing some good, that you were doing a place in the service that no one else could do. And that's what made you feel pretty good. And there were times when you were pleased because you could really help a person. Like that time in the Hirschkin Forest, I got a patient in there who was bleeding from a wound in his arm, and I knew he was dying because the blood was just pouring out. And so I gave him plasma and blood and shipped him into the operating room as soon as I could so that they could tie it off and, you know, do something.
And those are, I mean, truly life or death situations. If you make the wrong decision, it could cost someone his life.
That's right. And, you know, you had a doctor in charge of the war, but he was so busy that you had to do a lot of the things that he did.
Filda's hospital, the 96th Evacuation Hospital, treated nearly 25,000 wounded soldiers in Europe. And her experience there certainly prepared her for life after the war, when she became mom to 2 daughters, holding down the fort while Ted, who had been in the Marines in World War II, spent 22 more years in the Air Force. It's time for another break, but we'll hear from more mothers who can also proudly wear that label of World War II veteran when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special Mother's Day edition featuring just some of the amazing women who have shared their powerful stories here over the years. If you're ever in Washington, D.C., you have to take some time to experience the Women in Military Service for America Memorial right at the entrance to Arlington National Cemetery. It really captures the depth and the breadth of what women have done in our armed forces. And if you're in Colorado on Memorial Day, you've got to get to the Boulder Boulder. It's one of the largest Memorial Day events in the country, and you can meet one of the veterans who's going to be honored there this year, Lila Morrison. She was a nurse with the 118th Evacuation Hospital in Europe in World War II.
We only took care of emergencies. If we received casualties that we thought would live until they got back behind in a station or general hospital, we sent them back. But if we thought they wouldn't live long enough to make it back, then we accepted them. Our first tent was a doctor and several Corps boys. Patients were in there first, and he assessed them, divided them if they thought they could go back or if we had. So my tent was right behind him, and that was shock and pre-op. And my job was to bring fellas out of shock. Then if they were going to do surgery, which most of them had to have, I got them ready for surgery. And I had several Corps boys in there with me, helping me. One of the biggest things we did, see, this was back in the 40s, we had no way of preserving whole blood. And that's what all the boys needed. They need whole blood.
Because yeah.
If they weren't hemorrhaging, they had been. So this plasma, blood plasma, is what we gave, and that was supposedly at that time the next thing best to whole blood. It was conducted into a powder, and then we had a bottle of sterile water, and we mixed those together and gave them IV as quickly as we could.
And just by the sheer numbers and the reality of what some of these wounds and injuries are, I mean, you're faced with a situation where a good number of these young men who you're trying to help, you know they're not going to make it.
Yes, you did. Unfortunately, that was true.
How hard was that to deal with?
That was hard, very hard, because they were all young. Some of them, I was 22, like I say, and I know some of them were younger than I was. I'm sure they cheated a little on their age if their parents would sign. Oh, some of them never shaved, you know, just real young. But they had a wonderful spirit, every one of them. They were there to win that war. They loved America. They were so thankful to be an American. And even when it meant, and of course, all of them knew any minute could be the last. But none of them ever complained or said, I'm sorry I came, or any of that.
And you said what your job was. How did that work? You know, I don't want to dwell on gory details or any of that, but so we have a perspective of some of what you saw. Can you give us a sense of what the condition of some of these guys were, why they were in your hospital, and what you guys hoped to do for them?
Well, in order to serve, you had to be in good health.
Well, and what I mean is the nature of the injuries that you saw. I mean, I'm sure you said before nothing could have prepared you for it. You saw guys missing limbs?
Yes, missing limbs. Shot. You know, with as many as we saw, I'd say almost every place. Before we got down on the front, we were with what was called DS, Detached Service, and we worked in those hospitals and took care of, chronically. And many, many of them lost their limbs from frostbite. They would say, well, we were down in this foxhole, and we were there for a week. And it was cold. That was in December. Of course, the foxhole had snow in it, and it would melt. And they'd have to stand there in the water maybe for several days. I remember one saying, my socks were all wet, my feet were so cold, but nobody had a warm pair of socks. So it lasted long enough that they did get frostbites.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'd be so down when they lose a leg. They're just so depressed. And you hate to tell them that their leg was gone, or maybe both. But before it was over, when they'd go back behind the lines, they'd be in a ward with others with the same thing. And before you knew it, they'd be having races out in the hall in their wheelchair. All of them laughing and adjusting. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful, wasn't it?
And in this war that claimed millions of lives worldwide and 406,000 American lives, your job was to save lives.
Yes, and it seemed so different because we were the only ones there saving lives or trying to, and everybody else was taking lives.
And you said that your job was to take them from shock to pre-op.
Mm.
You've got to try to keep them alive.
Oh, yeah.
For that time period.
Mm.
And when you say bring them out of shock, how do you do that? What
are
you doing?
With the blood plasma.
So just their body's in physical shock. They can't function.
No. Many times they're passed out.
Yeah. So you can't talk to them. You can't encourage them in that situation. You're just trying to get life-saving plasma so they can make it till the surgeon can operate.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty intense.
Yes, it is. It doesn't get much more intense than that. And we realized it. We knew that. And that's one reason I was so thankful to be there, because I know we saved lives. Of course, we lost a lot, but we saved some, too. That was encouraging to think that you could be there and have the little bit of knowledge it took to bring them out of that shock and get them on their way to recovery.
Did you ever feel like this was too much for you, that you couldn't handle it anymore?
No, I didn't. See, I was just there a year. Maybe if I'd have been there 3 years, it would have.
I think a lot of people, if they were there 3 days.
Well, that's true, but nursing school prepares you for that. And I think my background, being in the small town and being the bottom of 7 children, it helped me a lot.
Toughened you up a little bit?
Yes, I think so.
And some people are under the mistaken impression that if you are operating a hospital, even a field hospital, an evacuation hospital like you had, that you're somehow safe, that the enemy's not going to shoot you. I think you learned otherwise, didn't you?
Yes, you did. On all of our tents, we had a big Red Cross, great big one. You could see that from the air. But as we got further down into France and Germany and some of those smaller countries, we were never bombed. We had what they call Bed Check Charlie. You've heard of that?
Every night, right?
Mm-hmm. They'd fly over to see what we're doing. We were under complete blackout, which was a little tougher because you had to go outside the tent in a flip there, you know.
Yeah.
Pull the curtain back. You tried to hurry because they told us how many feet up you could see that little light and to be very careful.
And so if they saw the light, Bed Check Charlie, this German bomber, knows where to drop his bomb.
Yes, that's right. And we saw mostly the Air Force with the Silver Star, our U.S. What a good feeling that was. You'd see many of them, you know, big noise flying over.
I don't want to be melodramatic here, but living with this every day, I mean, from the severe weather, and you're in a tent during the Battle of the Bulge, and you can't take a shower, you can't stay warm. I know you're surrounded by people who are worse off than you are because you're treating them every day. But, I mean, you're just confronted with death on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Did you consider the possibility that you might die over there?
Yes, I did, because I knew some of the hospitals had been bombed. I don't know, mistake or what, but in a situation like that, it's easy to make a mistake. But, like I said, we were never bombed.
And tell me if this is true. Brad Hoops, who interviewed you here in northern Colorado, shared a little bit of your story with me. He told me that you were ready to die yourself.
I was.
You prayed that if there were nurses that were going to die, let it be you and not those who had a husband and the children.
I did. Because I was young and single, and my siblings were all grown and on their own. And see, my mother and dad were both gone. So I just felt it would be so much easier for somebody like me to lose their life than some of those that had such ties at home. And we had boys, they sort of looked at us like a mother, a sister, aunt, and if we ever had time, they'd show us pictures they'd just gotten. And one that I particularly remembered, showed me a snap of a little boy, 3 years old. And he said, "This my little boy. I've never seen him." Mm-hmm. And where he lived and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So, and the boys were, their spirit and their outlook was just tremendous. I can't say enough good about them.
That's another World War II Army nurse, Leela Morrison. She would marry a man she met in the service and become a mother to three. We've heard from Army, Navy, Marine Corps already. The Coast Guard had women serving in the spars in World War II. But for decades, the work of pioneering female pilots in the war was kept classified. That's no longer the case. And when the WASPs, Women Air Force Service Pilots, were recognized with the Congressional Gold Medal in 2009, it allowed many more to learn about the courageous service of female pilots like Deanie Parrish.
Actually, what we did was no more than what almost every American did. They did something to help our country stay free. So I feel like that what I did was no more than what Rosie the Riveter did, or the women who drove fire trucks, or anything of that nature. We all did something to help our country stay free. And I think that was the important thing. And what did we do? We first, when we went into training, we had to have at least a private pilot's license to even apply to go into Army Air Force training. Now, my husband, who was also an Army Air Force pilot, when he started training, same training that I got, he had never been in an airplane. But things were different then, and for girls, we had to have a license before we could go into training. But all the training, well, the first two classes trained in Houston, but there was not adequate facilities there, so they moved it to Avenger Field out in Sweetwater in West Texas. And we went into training, and I trained there for 7 months. It was an Army Air Force. We had civilian instructors, but all we had 40 Army Air Force officers who were over the entire base. And when we got to Sweetwater, at that time, girls dressed up all the time. We wore high heels. We wore white gloves. We wore hats, you know. And we get to Sweetwater, and we were from all over the country. And we stayed in the only big hotel there, which was maybe four stories. But anyway, the next morning, we were all dressed up in our finest, but because we were going out to Avenger Field to meet Jacqueline Cochran and all of our instructors. So as we came downstairs and went outside, they said our transportation was there. There were three cow trailers lined up, and that's what our transportation was for the next 7 months. We got out to the airbase, and Miss Cochran was there and spoke to all of us. There were about 100 in my class to begin with. And I'll never forget what she said to us. Because, as I say, it was a different time, a different feeling. But she said to us, "You may be living in a man's world, and you may be flying a man's airplane, but when you get out of that airplane, I want you to remember you're a lady, and I want you to look like a lady, and I want you to act like a lady, and don't you forget it." So I never forgot. But then we were assigned our bays. We had six girls. We slept on Army cots in each bay. And we trained there for 7 months, the same training that any Army Air Force pilot received. At the end of that 7 months, over half my class had washed out. But the ones of us who were left, we graduated. And then we were assigned to 120 different air bases all over America. For me, I was sent first to Greenville, Mississippi, and as an engineering test pilot. If an aircraft had cracked up and had to have a new wing or anything major repair, it had to be flight tested before the instructors and cadets could fly in it again. And that was my job. But I was there about 2 months, and the operations officer said he wanted to check me out on twin engine aircraft. And about a week after that, I got orders to report down to Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. And when I went there, it was to go through B-26 Martin Marauder training to train gunners.
Well, I got to ask you here, Deanie. First, you say that you have to test these aircraft before the men can fly them. It makes you sound like a little bit like a guinea pig and like you're expendable. So if anything goes wrong, they just lose one of the WASPs and not one of their male pilots.
No.
And then
No, that's not true because okay. we had male engineering test pilots also.
Right, okay.
Because there weren't enough of us to do everything.
So they were guinea pigs of both genders.
Absolutely.
But then they put you in an airplane, the B-26. I'm sure you're familiar with all the awful nicknames that airplane had because of the problems
Absolutely.
That it had.
One a day in Tampa Bay.
And you were down there.
I lived 90 miles from Tampa, and my family was not too pleased when I went into B-26 training. But then once I got through, I was retained there as an air-to-air tow target pilot to train gunners for combat. And that's what I did until we were disbanded.
Did you ever, and I have a feeling what your answer is going to be, because you've already echoed what I think is the most important message this show ever gets out, that during this time in our nation's history, everybody was doing something, and everybody was pulling in the same direction to preserve the freedom that we enjoy today. But while you were doing this and training other people to go fight the battles and to go drop the bombs and do everything that they did, was there ever part of you that wished, you know what, I would like to go fly one of those missions like the guys can?
Yes, but we knew that was impossible. When we went in, we were told, of course, that we would not be flying outside the continental United States. But what we did was we took over some of the jobs. Certainly there were not enough of us to take over all the jobs, but we did jobs to relieve male pilots for combat because they, in the early part of 42, we had lost so many combats, especially over North Africa, until there was a tremendous shortage of male pilots, combat pilots. So the jobs that we took over from male pilots so that there could be more combat pilots.
How were you treated by the male pilots? Did you get the sense that they appreciated everything that you did? I'm sure there was one bad apple in the bunch that didn't treat you so well.
Well, I never ran into that bad apple, I'm happy to say. I did my job. I never refused to do anything. And sometimes we were asked to fly, perhaps in weather that maybe the male pilots weren't flying. But it was our duty, and we did it. And I never got anything other than nice treatment. Now, I can't say that for every WASP, because I know that some of them have told me stories of what happened to them. But for me, they were very appreciative of our help.
You know, you mentioned having to fly sometimes in bad weather, and 38 WASPs were killed during World War II as they carried out their different duties across the country. Did you ever have any close calls or some times in the sky where you thought, uh-oh, this might be it for me?
Yes, I got in flying my air-to-air tow target missions. That target was not out far enough sometimes because we would have a B-24 that would come by. We would put down quarter flaps or whatever. They would come by, and they had seven turrets in that B-24, and those green gunners were shooting live ammunition with color-coded bullets at that target. And sometimes the target wasn't far enough behind us. So a couple of times got a few holes in the tail. But with God's help, I got through it. I hope the American people are getting an education about this overlooked history, because it is inspirational history. Because what we did, we didn't compromise the values that we had grown up with just because we were pilots. Honor above everything, patriotism, integrity, service, all of those things that are so important that I just feel like generations to come, they should be allowed to read about that history. And let me tell you, it was both an honor and a privilege to serve this country, and I hope every member of our armed forces today feels the same way. And God bless you for caring.
And God bless Deanie Parrish, who will celebrate Mother's Day with her daughter Nancy, who launched an organization called Wings Across America and a traveling exhibit called Fly Girls to tell the story of WASP pioneers like her mom. Mother and daughter Deanie and Nancy were inducted together into the Women in Aviation Hall of Fame in 2015. There are just a couple more things I want to mention as we bring this special Mother's Day edition to a close. First, if you know any Blue Star moms, women whose children are currently serving serving in our armed forces. Find a way to reach out to them this Mother's Day and keep them and their children in your prayers. And finally, I have to say a happy Mother's Day to the one-time Army nurse who I'm proud to call my mom. Remember, you can find links to all the full-length original interviews with the women you heard from today at hometownheroesradio.com. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you're reminded again today through the stories of some amazing mothers who also happen to be World War II veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.